This is Tax Update for Saturday, September the 30th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, September the 30th, 2006. This week, a defining issue, who is an employee? The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, they're located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Well, this week I've now gotten back from my trip to Roanoke, Virginia, speaking at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference, as well as a presentation I made for the Tennessee Society of CPAs in Memphis on Wednesday. So recording this here on Friday and getting ready to go over a case that came down just this week discussing an issue that comes up from time to time with our clients. Quite often our clients get into the question of, well, who is an employee and who is not an employee? What type of service providers are employees? What types of service providers can be treated as not employees? And this week we're going to look at the case of Orion Contracting Trust versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memo 2006-211. Now, the case in question appears to involve a taxpayer who got involved with a promoter that was pushing a trust concept on them and had a few other tax ideas that were, shall we say, somewhat interesting. But the case does provide a fairly decent analysis both of what makes someone into an employee, as well as a look at why the tax court in this case, despite what appeared to be less than flattering circumstances, shall we say, or less than sympathetic circumstances for the taxpayer, still found that the fraud penalty did not apply in this case. Now, in Orion Contracting, we have basically the case of employee versus contractor. And it's important to note that for both the, quote, employer and the contractor and the individual who's doing the services, there are reasons why each one of them may prefer this to be structured as an independent contractor relationship. Now, quite often we think about it from the entity hiring the service provider. In fact, that's the way the IRS seems to tend to always think about it, that the advantages are there if they can treat them as not an employee. In a situation where the service provider is not an employee, the service recipient, the entity contracting with the independent contractor, is not responsible for the payroll taxes that are normally paid on employees. As well, certain other employee benefits may not have to be paid to that individual if they're not treated as an employee. If they truly are not an employee, they may be excluded from the qualified plan of the entity, making that less expensive. And they may, if they truly are not an employee, not have to be covered under the workers' compensation plan for the state in question. All of these things presume we have a legitimate individual who is truly not an employee. However, from the service provider's standpoint, there are actually some advantages to them. Now, at first glance, it appears to be a not good situation because the service provider now gets responsibility for the entire payment of what is the FICA equivalent, this time the self-employment tax. So, therefore, rather than just having one half of the FICA withheld from their paycheck, FICA and Medicare taxes, they now end up through the self-employment tax mechanism paying the equivalent of both sides of the transaction, the employer and the employee. However, even with that, there still are some advantages to the service provider if they are treated as an independent contractor. One initial advantage is the FICA for the employee is imposed on the gross amount paid to the employee generally, with very few exclusions. For the service provider who's an independent contractor, the self-employment tax is imposed on the net earnings of the individual. As well, a service provider who is an independent contractor is able to take a deduction for the expenses he or she incurs above the line for income tax purposes in computing AGI. An employee is gravely disadvantaged under the Internal Revenue Code in getting expenses that they incur personally related to their trade or business. While the Internal Revenue Code recognizes that being an employee is being in the trade or business, the code also provides that that individual can only get a deduction for expenses they pay in their trade or business as an itemized deduction. That itemized deduction is a miscellaneous itemized deduction subject to the 2% of adjusted gross income haircut, and also is non-deductible for purposes of the alternative minimum tax. A number of key negatives. As well, a true independent contractor service provider can set up his or her own qualified retirement plan, SEP, SIMPLE, those types of programs, and basically provide for their own retirement without regard for what the service recipient provides for their employees. So I can decide to stash back my limits, while if I'm an employee, I'm stuck with the plans that the employer offers. And if the employer doesn't offer a plan, I'm going to be limited to just an IRA contribution. That quite often will be substantially less than I could put back if I was able to treat myself as an independent contractor and establish my own profit-sharing plan, solo 401k, establish my own SEP, establish my own defined benefit pension plan. So there are clearly reasons why I would like to be, as a service recipient, an independent contractor in many situations. Now, that said, the IRS rarely sees somebody they don't believe is an employee if the situation is at all close. And the IRS tends to want to reclassify people as employees. There are some obvious reasons for that from the IRS's perspective. Most significantly, compliance is highest among those who receive wage income. Wage income is reported on the W-2s, there are taxes withheld, and that income tends to be reported much, much more regularly than income from trade or business received by an individual, which the IRS understands, and quite correctly understands, often is not properly reported by the individual or not reported at all on a tax return. And because there's no tax withheld, there is somewhat less incentive to report that income because they're not going to file a return to get back some money or to get a refund. In fact, normally the problem becomes these individuals discover they owe taxes they haven't paid their estimates. Therefore, even those that report are more likely to become individuals who end up with unpaid tax liabilities and get into the collections process. So for various reasons, the IRS clearly has a strong preference for individuals to be treated as employees. In Orion, we have a taxpayer that got involved with an organization, as noted before, known as American Asset Protection. And they set up a trust which would run the business that these two individuals currently had been running as a partnership, or at least apparently had been running as a partnership prior to the trust. Now, one problem they had is one of the promoters was their initial trustee. He had to resign after he had some legal run-ins and some problems. So this wasn't a good situation in that regard. But the marketed plan basically was designed to run the construction business, basically, and part of the contract with American Asset Protection included a provision that American Asset Protection would prepare an independent contractor agreement for the individuals that work for Orion. Now, based on the case, it's not clear that such agreements were ever prepared for the service providers who worked for Orion, but at least that was the idea. They were going to become independent contractors. Now, the trust ran, according to the court, a construction and remodeling business doing repairing and patching concrete, mixing and applying concrete, and other types of construction work. So we have an operating business. This business engaged the services of a number of individuals, and these individuals performed both skilled and unskilled labors related to this concrete work. While a few of the individuals provided a limited number of their own tools, generally the supplies, including the concrete, were provided by Orion for each job. And Orion decided which locations individuals were going to work at and essentially when they worked there and how they were going to work. Now, Orion, when we got to court, was claiming these individuals were independent contractors. The IRS was claiming the opposite. Now, they were independent contractors, so not surprisingly, according to Orion, they were independent contractors. Orion did not file forms W-3, W-2, or 941, 940, any of the payroll tax reports for this particular for these particular individuals. Of course, a more interesting aside was that Orion also failed to file forms 1096 and 1099, which should have been filed for any of the service providers who received over $600 if they were truly independent contractors. That may not be terribly surprising because the trust also never filed a form 1041, and the two owners didn't file their 1997 and 1998 individual tax returns either. So apparently filing tax returns was not something that our two individuals here were too concerned with after this particular engagement. It appears that part of the deal they were structured with was one that was to reduce their income taxes, apparently by getting them out of the system in some ways. Now, the IRS examined the returns in question, and there was a bit of back and forth for obtaining the records of the company that went on. The IRS had some trouble getting those records. Eventually, they did obtain them from various sources. Part of the examination that they went under focused on the status of the individuals. And the IRS decided these individuals were employees and issued its assessments of taxes on July 28th of 2004. Now, the trust filed in tax court and challenged the assessment on three issues. Number one, they claimed the workers were not employees of the trust. Number two, since these involved cases from the late 80s, the trust claimed that the statute of limitations had expired, and so they couldn't assess any tax against them. And finally, the trust asserted that their failure to file payroll tax return was not fraudulent, so any tax assessment against them should not have applied against it the fraud penalty. The tax court would disagree on their first two positions, but did agree with the trust on the final position that the fraud penalty did not apply. Now, the court first very quickly dealt with the issue of the statute of limitations. The court noted the trust had not filed any payroll tax reports of any sort. As such, the court noted, there was still an open statute on all of those reports. Now, that raises the interesting aside that if, in fact, the trust had not taken the position that nobody was an employee, but rather had taken the position that only certain individuals were not employees, the statute might have run. All they needed was a 941. But they had no 941s, no W-2s, no 940s, so all the payroll tax forms were still open and available. Now, in the case, the court's first footnote suggests strongly that the individuals were really arguing this point based on number of tax protester arguments. That's the term the court used. But the result is a reminder of the risk you have in any case where you take a position that no returns are necessary, that in essence you're going to take the aggressive position and claim that everybody is an independent contractor. You have no returns filed. You have not started the statute. If, in fact, the IRS is to prevail down the line and or asserts that individuals are employees, they don't have to worry about the statute because you've never tripped it. You've never started it running. In a case like this, prudence might dictate, though this doesn't seem like prudence was one of their key issues they were worried about, but prudence might dictate that, in fact, you don't aggressively say no one is an employee. You just take a look and try to find those who would be most apt not to be employees and go that route if you're going to go this direction. Now, on the general issue of who is an employee, the court noted that normally they apply seven criteria. The first criteria that is applied is the degree of control exercised by the individual that we claim is the employer. The more control an individual exercises over the service provider, the more it looks like an employee. For instance, in my accounting firm, the employees of my firm, generally I control which jobs they work on, I control what their assignments are, and myself and my partner basically decide, you know, tell them when they are to be there, what they're to do, and control and direct their work. In the alternative, when we as a firm are providing services to our clients as an independent contractor, and I think there's little doubt that we qualify as that, and truly independent in those cases, we generally have the discretion on how the job will be done. we generally do not work under the specific direction of the clients that hire us. The clients that hire us to, for instance, perform a review of a financial statement. They hire us to perform the preparation of an income tax return. We handle the exact details of taking care of that. We even handle the scheduling of when that's going to take place and how it's handled, who takes care of it, which employees we designate to do that. In essence, we have much more independence. The degree of control is a very important specific item in determining who is an employee and who is not. Number two criteria, which party invests in the work facilities used by the individual? Again, taking my accounting firm as an example. For my employees, they don't invest in the computer equipment they use. They don't invest in the building that we work in. They're not investing in providing the supplies. Our firm invests in doing those things. Those individuals are employees. But similarly, for the clients that hire us to perform accounting services, in that standpoint, then our firm does provide almost all of those items and truly provides the work facilities and all of the work supplies necessary. Number three, the opportunity of the individual for profit or loss. Again, using the accounting firm as the example here, the employees have virtually no risk of loss. They will receive their paycheck and their paycheck is set. They are not responsible for virtually any of the expenses involved. The firm is responsible for that. On the case, though, where we take on a client, we, meaning the firm, does take on the risk of loss. We have the investment, we put the expenses up, we hire the employees that work on the client, and we have the risk, if we don't get asked for the right fee for the job, that we will end up being the ones losing money at the end of the day. So we have a true risk of loss. That makes our firm less apt to be considered to be a employee and more apt to be considered a true independent contractor. Number four, whether the principal can discharge the individual. In essence, are they able to terminate the contract at will, and can they terminate the individuals? Now, probably my clients can terminate our services basically at will, though there may be cases where a contract has been signed and essentially they're not able to terminate us without basically paying us for the completion of the contract. Nevertheless, employees are usually considered employed at will. In that case, the employees may be able to be terminated at will. Again, in this case, the situation is not quite as straightforward, but generally it shows some relationship. An employee generally is able to be terminated more easily than a contractor that the entity has entered into a contract with to perform a service. For the contractor, they pretty much have to show breach of contract. For the employee, it's normally employment at will. Number six is the permanency of the relationship. In essence, does the person continue to work and perform all their services for the same individual? The longer and more drawn out the permanency is, the more apt they're doing their work for that one entity, the more apt it is to be an employee. Employees tend to work for the same company for a period of time. That's where they tend to work, is to have a permanent relationship. A contractor may have a very impermanent relationship. In essence, they only appear as the need occurs. Now, in an accounting firm, that's not quite as simple because, of course, we have recurring engagements that continually come up. Tax returns have to be filed every year. Financial statements have to be prepared. So, again, this is not the perfect solution as to which is which, but it is one criteria. And number seven is the relationship the parties believe they were creating. If the parties believe they were creating an employment relationship, that argues we probably have employment. If the parties believe they were setting up an independent contractor, that helps argue for independent contractor status. Now, in this case, the court found in Orion that the overwhelming evidence indicated these individuals were employees. Now, the court notes on those seven criteria, there's no real scoring system or perfect way to weight them, but the court did indicate that an extremely important criteria is the first one, who has a level of control exercised over the job that is done. And in this case, they found that in Orion, clearly Orion had the control over the exact way a job was performed. In addition, they noted that the individuals involved were performing only exactly the type of service that Orion sold to the public. Now again, in our case with the accounting firm, arguably my employees are performing the service given to the public, but then again, not really quite. They tend to perform more specialized duties. We have a broader service we perform, so they perform subparts of those services. They noted in Orion that many of these individuals had a permanent relationship with the trust. It appeared to be the only people they were working for was the trust, and they continued that for the whole period under exam. And there was virtually no risk of loss to these individuals. They could not lose money, essentially, because they didn't have any real risk of loss. The only factors the court found suggest an independent contractor relationship might exist was the general indication that they wanted to create an independent contractor relationship and that a few tools were provided by the employees. The court noted, while evidence of the party's understanding of the relationship is one factor we consider, it is not enough to overcome the weight of the other factors which clearly evidence an employer-employee relationship. So for this reason, the court held that under the common law test, these individuals were employees of Orion. Now, it's important to remember that even if a taxpayer has this finding go against them, there is still one more way to save the day in terms of treating these individuals as independent contractors. And that is to qualify for relief under Section 530 of the Revenue Act of 1978. Important caveat, when we say Section 530 relief, we're not talking about 530 in the code, which is a totally unrelated provision, but we're talking about what's an uncodified provision in the Revenue Act of 1978. That has been modified a couple of times, but generally it provides a safe harbor relief of sorts for companies that have treated individuals as independent contractors, and there are a number of showings and issues you have to cover. But one of the key ones, which in this case is why the court decided there's no issue, is that in order to get Section 530 relief, you must have filed the 1099s and treated them consistently as contractors, meaning filed the required reporting form. Now, the court noted that in this case, Orion did not give forth a reason why 530 should apply. But then it goes on to note, even if petitioner had sought Section 530 relief, such relief would be denied because the petitioner did not file any returns with respect to the individuals in question, as required by Section 530A1B. So even if there was a chance of getting 530 relief, the failure to file 1099s clobbered it. Generally, if individuals are being treated as contractors, you would like to qualify for 530 relief or at least raise the 530 issue if the IRS challenges your treatment. What that means is you absolutely need to make sure that the 1099s are issued and treated them consistently as if they were independent contractors, with the required 1099s being issued for those that have income for the year of greater than $600 for services performed. Now, after deciding this, the court was asked to decide one more issue, and that is, was Orion's actions, were they so far out in left field that they constituted a fraud? Now, the IRS was arguing, look, this entity clearly was trying to evade taxes, and the fact they failed to file payroll tax returns was very persuasive evidence of the fraudulent intent. But the tax court in this case, being generous, didn't agree, deciding that the failure to file a payroll tax form by itself is not necessarily complete evidence of fraud. It's not an open and closed case. The court noted, respondent first argued the petitioner's failure to file any employment tax returns for the workers is evidence of fraud. The failure to file a return, even over an extended period, does not per se establish fraud, and it quotes the case of Marcellus versus Commissioner, references that, a Fifth Circuit case from 1977. However, an extended pattern of failing to file tax returns may be persuasive circumstantial evidence of the fraud. But in this case, the court found that their failure to file the employment tax returns is mitigated by the technical nature of the questioning employee status in this case. The court goes on to say, quote, we do know the petitioner also failed to file the required Form 1099 for each of the alleged independent contractors who has paid more than $600. While this failure is inconsistent with petitioner's position concerning the status of the workers, we do not find it evidence of fraud. Accordingly, we find petitioner's failure to file employment tax returns is not compelling evidence of fraud on these facts. The IRS said, well, wait a second, one more issue. they made it difficult for us to get the forms and the information we wanted. The court on this one found it a bit closer, but said, we find petitioner's conduct with respect to the IRS, both before and after the employment examination began, to be less than cooperative, but there is no evidence the petitioner destroyed any evidence or attempted to mislead the respondent. In essence, they may have been a little bit difficult to get documents out of, but they didn't take any actions that indicated an affirmative attempt to basically hide these matters from the IRS. The court went on to note that since the IRS had not argued for a lesser penalty, such as for negligence, the court did not consider that issue once it had decided the fraud penalty did not apply. Backdoor, the court was saying, IRS, you really should have come to court with a backup position that would have allowed us to apply a negligence or some other penalty. The fact that you went with one swing for the fraud penalty, ignored everything else, means we're going to basically let them off without penalties. We're just assessing the tax, and they're going to pick up the interest. Now, what does this case tell us? Well, it's a good review case to go over a couple of issues with clients who walk in the door and decide they don't want to treat individuals as employees. First, you can go over with them the issues and some of the exposures you have if you don't treat individuals as employees. You can go over the factors in Orion and show how these individuals were going to be treated by the court as employees and the importance of the control test. To the extent that they control these individuals, that's going to make it very difficult to argue these individuals are not employees of the entity. As well, you can show that going for the hoggish position of saying nobody in my organization is an employee creates a real exposure where the statute of limitation never shuts down because we've never filed payroll tax reports. Finally, you can take a look at this as evidence of what goes on just because somebody down the road does something, gets away with it. In essence, I'm sure this asset protection group had a number of people who had been, quote, doing this for years and never had a problem, that it doesn't necessarily mean you'll never have the problem. Now, as I said, this week I got my way back from Tennessee. I'm actually back in town. I'm going to stay in town working through the 15th filing deadlines that we all have coming up. And this year, actually, the 16th of October individual filing deadlines that are coming up. My next road trip comes up when we get to the week following all of that. That'll be for the week beginning on the 23rd of October. And I'll be doing a trip to Ohio again, running through a few cities, three cities in Ohio in 3 nights. It makes it kind of interesting. Doing the current federal tax developments lectures for the Ohio Society of CPAs. So if you look in there, you can find where I'm going to be talking about recent developments on an 8-hour course. That ought to make it kind of interesting and fun. But until then, I'll be staying here in Phoenix. And so we'll be looking at working with new tax update issues as developments come forward. Now, this has been the Tax Update for September 30th. Remind you, Tax Update is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Go ahead and visit them and take a look at their offerings for their subscribers. This has been the Tax Update.